Welcome to the day after one of the most important primaries that we've had so far edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. It's 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting, and I hope you're listening to us across the state of Georgia. So much to talk about in terms of the results of the primary. And then just to make our job even more interesting today, President Obama, just about 3 hours ago, announced his nominee for the vacancy in the United States Supreme Court. We're going to start with that with our panel. Today, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him in the Dead Tree edition of the paper every Thursday and Sunday. And then he oversees Political Insider, the online blog that keeps you up to date hour by hour as to what's going on in politics. Loretta Lepore, Republican consultant, is with us. She was also the co-chair of Carly Fiorina's presidential campaign here in Georgia. We're terrifically excited to have you back. Thank you for being here, Loretta.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Former Congressman Buddy Darden.
Democratic Congressman.
From Cobb County is with us, as he often is. And we welcome for the first time to the Political Rewind studios, Kevin Riley. He happens to be Jim Galloway's boss,
whatever he says is right.
He's the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Kevin, thanks so much for coming
in. I'm glad. Thank you for the invitation.
Sure.
Glad to be here.
Well, I mean, one of the things we're going to count on you to talk about is you know Ohio better than anybody else at this table, that's for sure, having spent so many years there. And we're going to want to talk about John Kasich up there.
Okay, I have a few stories to tell.
All right, good. But let's start with the nominee. Merrick Garland, he is chief of the Washington District Court, one of the most esteemed courts, often called kind of the number two court in the land. Buddy Darden's nodding over that. And the president nominated him officially about 11 o'clock this morning in a Rose Garden ceremony. And in his comments, made it clear that he continues to be aware that Republicans have put a position, have kind of become intransigent in their talking about whether they're going to have hearings or not. So let's start real quickly by just hearing a little bit of what the president had to say.
I said I would take this process seriously, and I did. I chose a serious man and an exemplary judge, Merrick Garland. Now, I recognize that we have entered the political season, or perhaps these days it never ends, a political season that is even noisier and more volatile than usual. It is tempting to make this confirmation process simply an extension of our divided politics, the squabbling that's going on in the news every day. But to go down that path would be wrong. It would be a betrayal of our best traditions and a betrayal of the vision of our founding documents. At a time when our politics are so polarized, at a time when norms and customs of political rhetoric and courtesy and comedy are so often treated like they're disposable, this is precisely the time when we should play it straight and treat the process of appointing a Supreme Court justice with the seriousness and care it deserves.
So the president made those comments, finished up about 11:20, and within an hour, we got a statement from Senator David Perdue, who's on the Judiciary Committee, and I tell you what he said. He said, the Constitution is clear. The president shall nominate judges to the Supreme Court, but the power to grant or withhold consent of such nominees rests exclusively with the United States Senate. What's at stake here is the balance of our nation's highest court and the direction of our country for decades. And here's an interesting line, Buddy Darden. I remain firm in my decision to exercise my constitutional authority and withhold consent of any nominee to the Supreme Court submitted by President Obama. That's an odd sentence.
Very odd, because the selection of Judge Garland is a quintessentially mainstream choice. And I listened to every word of the president's statement, and he outlined a very, very distinguished record going back to the time that he was a prosecutor for the Oklahoma City bombings up until his present service as chief judge of the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and he drew rave reviews both from the right and the left of his former colleagues. So there's an unassailable nominee here, and I think that the Senate fails to consider him at their own peril.
Jim Galloway, I recognize that sometimes statements like that are drawn up relatively hastily, and so, you know, maybe all the language isn't vetted. But what I found surprising is claiming that the constitutional authority to withhold consent on any nominee to the Supreme Court of Obama.
Well, I think the Constitution is positive on that. Yeah. That the Senate shall advise and consent, not shall withhold. This is, look, I mean, you got to credit Obama. He made this choice as difficult as possible. The guy's got 19 years on the bench. He's 63 years old, which means he's not going to be there forever. So it's, he's not an ideologue. And as Buddy said, he was a former federal prosecutor.
Oklahoma City bombings were under
Timothy
his.
Timothy McVeigh that needle ride. And he's got all the Republican endorsements from what?
Orrin Hatch?
Yeah, Orrin Hatch from the mid 90s.
Yeah.
So it's a hard one to. Now there's already some talk that you've got that should Hillary Clinton win the White House in November that they would go ahead and give Obama a lame duck appeal or confirmation of it.
Well, and here's what's interesting to me. You said the magic number, Loretta. He's 63 years old. Now, when I heard his age, one of the things I couldn't help but wonder about is President Obama saying to the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate, well, you can take a guy from me who's a little bit older and whose duration on the court is, we don't know, or you could wait for the potential of a Hillary Clinton presidency, and she can put a guy in who's 43 and will be there for 30 years, right?
Well, I think this whole situation really becomes a more compounded problem for the Republican Party. You know, I heard in the statement that it was a balance, and there's a balance politically in the U.S. Senate, as most of 34 of those senators go up for reelection. And there's a division within the party, even on this issue, because there are many in the party that feel as though there should be movement on this nominee from the perspective of at least vetting him, allowing the meetings, meeting with the president's nominee, because if not, the Democrats again get to paint the Republicans as the party of no, as the party of obstruction. So whether they actually take the vote before the election is one thing, but they should be open to the meetings. So there's a real perception problem here that the party is creating for itself. And I recognize that I am one part of the Republican Party that has this view. David Perdue is representing in his commentary another part of the party that has a very different viewpoint on this. And so, you know, again, we're at that schism. I really think that the leadership in the U.S. Senate needs to rethink this.
Kevin, the president today in his remarks said, I'm sending up to the Hill tomorrow for meetings with members of the Judiciary Committee. Question is, are any doors going to be open for these meetings?
Right. Now, I don't think it's any coincidence that it was this morning. It wasn't even this afternoon after yesterday's primaries. It was like almost for Washington, first thing in the morning. And I think that's the message, right? It's a simple thing. Look, you can take this guy, which clearly puts the Republicans in a tough spot, or you can wait because it sure looks like we're going to have Hillary against Trump. And I think the Democrats feel pretty confident that in that race that, you know, Hillary could come out and the Republicans will face a much more difficult choice. But I thought the timing was one of the best things about it. And then the other thing I'm looking forward to is when Saturday Night Live finally gets a hold of all of this. So.
By the way, we're at Politics GPB. If you want to tweet us and give us your insights about how you feel about what's happening, either the Supreme Court nomination today or the Republican and Democratic primaries last night, we'd love to hear your thoughts. So I think one of the other things that's fascinating about this, and Loretta, you already alluded to it, and it kind of leads us into the conversation, is, boy, this, Jim, here we are, the heart of the primary season. Last night, we kind of came close to having an understanding it's going to be Trump versus Clinton, likely, and this throws the Supreme Court nomination even more directly into the middle of the presidential race.
Throws it into the middle of the presidential campaign. And look, you've got I would suspect that every Republican presidential candidate who is surviving right now, I mean Trump, Cruz, and Kasich, will be asked, are you willing to give up a Supreme Court nominee in the fourth year of your term? I think that's just a very natural question.
Yeah.
And it's a terrible precedent.
It is a terrible precedent. Plus, I think David Perdue, our senator, looks somewhat childish and petty here. And why not give the guy a hearing, meet with him, and then he could decide maybe he wasn't the right one. They could stall it with no problem at all. The Senate's masters of that. But at least sit down, talk with him, and pretend to go through the motion.
Isn't that what the Democrats did with Robert Bork? I mean, in the end, they did have all the hearings. They listened to him. They vetted him and then voted
him.
And
they voted him down. Right. They voted him down.
Yeah.
Apparently, we have some Democrats listening today because we've gotten some tweets from people who clearly want this nomination to get a fair hearing. Why isn't this? Says they're impeding and exceeding authority that we, the people, gave them. And we got another tweet from TB says, TB says to the GOP, play political hardball. So send us your tweets. Demdog says, It is the constitutional duty to have hearings. They don't have to approve them, but they must have hearings. Okay, well, we'll watch this unfold. It's going to be fascinating as we get into the real meat of seeing this play out in the campaign. So let's talk presidential politics for a little while. Last night, Jim, biggest night Hillary Clinton probably has had in her entire career as a candidate for president or any other office.
She set her expectations at Florida and North Carolina last night. She picked up Ohio and Illinois, her home state. That would have been a nice loss of face if had she lost that. But she picked up Ohio, which has demographically is a good bit like Michigan, which means she's kind of recovered herself on the with the blue collar crowd, I think.
Let's listen to what she told her supporters at her rally.
Our commander in chief has to be able to defend our country, not embarrass it. Engage our allies, not alienate them. Defeat our adversaries, not embolden them. When we hear a candidate for president call for rounding up 12 million immigrants, banning all Muslims from entering the United States, when he embraces torture, that doesn't make him strong. It makes him wrong. And yes, our next president.
So that's Hillary Clinton. Kevin, she's already making the turn to the general election in that by attacking Donald Trump, who in that section of the speech doesn't name, but does later.
Right. Well, you know, one of the other things she did in that speech is she made a very brief reference to 2008. And a lot of people forget this. Hillary Clinton in the primary in 2008 beat Barack Obama. So that Ohio is a very comfortable place for her. And I think she also knows that without Ohio, of course, the path to the presidency for a Republican candidate is close to impossible.
So Loretta, so here's the big question I think that Democrats are really asking today, and I'd love you to weigh in on this. Bernie Sanders has all the money in the world to compete as long as he would like to in this race. There are some states, as you look down in the, you know, the last 40-some states that have to vote that seem to be good fertile ground for him. But the nomination appears now to be just about out of reach. And so the question is, does he have a decision to make? How long do you stay in? You can stay in if you have the resources, but to what end? And in the long run, are you hurting your party's eventual nominee?
I think in this case, to your point, Bernie does have the money because most of his money is coming from the people that support him. They're low donors, but there are massive amounts of them. And Bernie Sanders is in this race to make a point. He's got some key messages he wants out there. I don't think that when he entered this, and I think there are probably not many of us at this table that think that he entered this race thinking he was going to be the party's nominee, but he had a goal of raising to the fore the issues that he feels have been ignored thus far by his party. And he's going to continue as long as he can to continue to reinforce those messages.
But you're a Clinton supporter. Is Bernie Sanders now threatening the eventual nomination, not threatening whether she wins the nomination, but creating a situation that is going to drag her down as a general election candidate. He keeps pushing her to the left. She's done a fairly good job resisting that. And maybe now she's got enough delegates in her pocket that she can resist even further. But is this a bad thing for the party?
Well, in my opinion, I think Bernie Sanders has achieved his maximum goal here. And the only way for him to go now is down. And so I think his influence right now is probably at its greatest point. And he could step out in the next few weeks, I think, with great honor and a whole lot of glory. But the longer he stays, he's beginning to wear thin. And the longer he stays in, I think the more he becomes a persona non grata to the rest of the party.
Let me disagree with you there. As long as it remains a kind of a cordial competition, I would say that he may be doing Hillary and Democrats a favor by keeping hold on these voters that are just so upset with the system and might be tempted to go over to Trump.
He's getting more and more strident, Bernie is. And he's becoming more and more emboldened, and I think he's about to cross the line here.
It's not just the disaffected. It's the young voters, and the young voters that Barack Obama carried that Hillary Clinton cannot carry. And he's keeping them engaged. And once he exits, those young people might also exit the process.
Well, I think that's true, yeah. I think it's true, Bill, because more and more what you're hearing is that it used to be campaigns were about the undecideds. But now it's becoming more and more about getting the people who should vote for you out. And I think that strategy of keeping the kind of voter that Bernie Sanders connects with engaged and involved and perhaps influencing ultimately Hillary again in an election, especially if she runs against Donald Trump, where the Democrats may feel a little more comfortable about winning.
But at some point, you've got to take them over. You just can't leave them out there. And how does Hillary bring them into the fold? And I think Bernie can help her now.
Well, yeah, you do it the same way that Obama brought Hillary supporters into the fold in June of 2008. It was pretty late, but they kept going through there. And I think Hillary in the end did Obama a favor.
Well, we'll watch to see. I look at Bernie Sanders and sort of understand your point, buddy, because Illinois, Ohio should have been fertile ground for Bernie Sanders in many ways, right? Kevin, you know Ohio well. I mean, there's a lot of similarities between Ohio and Michigan in terms of the working people of the state. But it feels like they did get sour on the Bernie Sanders message.
Yeah, that's sure what it looks like. I mean, maybe if Hillary had written an op-ed thing like Romney back in 2012 and said, let GM go bankrupt, maybe then Bernie could have won. But I think that, again, as a native Ohioan, Ohioans are realists, they're pragmatic. And I think that people may have looked at it and just said, he really can't win. So let's go in another direction.
Jim, one other, just a final thought about the Democratic race. The Sanders people tried to make a lot out of Mayor Rahm Emanuel's ties to Hillary and Bill Clinton and his involvement, of course, in the Clinton White House, his work there. Rahm Emanuel may be the single most, or certainly in the top five, of the most disliked mayors in the United States, and they really tried to go get that attached to Hillary. It just didn't work at all.
No, and the problem there is if you go after Rahm Emanuel, you're not really going after Hillary. You're going after Barack Obama, and that doesn't sell in Chicago.
Right.
That's right. He was chief of staff for Barack Obama after he worked in the Clinton White House. Good point.
Okay, let's talk Republican politics just for a couple minutes. I want to talk about Donald Trump just for a moment, and then we're going to take a break and come back and really talk about the dynamics of the race, okay? So, last night I thought we heard some really inspiring words at different times from the candidates, and we'll play a few of them. Your former governor, back when you were an Ohio man, John Kasich, gave a very moving speech. Marco Rubio actually gave one of his best speeches. So I want to play this for you and get your response, if you feel like I did. Here's how Donald Trump chose to celebrate the single biggest night in his very young political career.
And it's sort of interesting because I was watching the news a little while ago, and one of the commentators, who I'm not particularly fond of, but these are minor details, said, but Donald Trump doesn't get over 50%. Because I'm at 43, 45, actually now, according to The Economist, I'm at 53. And I have to explain to these people, they don't understand basic physics, basic mathematics, basic whatever you want to call it. When I don't get over 50, we have four people, right? We have four people. Do you understand that? Well, that's an amazing achievement just mathematically when you can get over 50%. So someday they're going to understand. Someday when we take it all, they'll understand. But it is really ridiculous.
So, Loretta Lepore, maybe, hey, thank you to all the people out there who supported me. What a wonderful night this was. He was tweeting, watching the coverage, and tweeting how much he dislikes Megyn Kelly.
Right. What? On Fox News, yeah. Which is, you know, yeah. A lot of Republican yeah. voters watch. I mean, yes, he kind of missed the ball on that one. He's gotten so far in the weeds, as he'll tell you, he's his own campaign manager. And it's all about him. He's calling the strategy. He's watching the polls. He's got four people. And really missed the point of thanking those voters in these very, very key states. Who got out and voted for him.
I think, though, there might be something else to it that we should think about. The first thing is the percentage of vote that he's gotten has grown. Remember early in the polls when it was like 20% and everyone was talking about it's really just this disaffected group? With each one of these primaries, you've seen that percentage grow. It's not 50. So he accomplished that, you know, pointing out that it keeps growing. And then the other thing is, I mean, he's basically saying to his supporters, ignore the media. Listen to me, through me, directly to me. I think those are two really important parts of his campaign. I can win, and we're against Washington and everything in the establishment. And I think that was his message.
I think the part on growing his base is very accurately portrayed in the Florida turnout, because Florida was a closed primary. And they've been saying heretofore that he's won the open primaries, Ted Cruz wins the closed primaries, but Florida was a closed primary. Not only did he take it by a large margin, there was a very high turnout in Florida, which means that you had Republicans voting who probably don't vote in primary elections, and you had people voting for the first time. So that really showed that it is him motivating, whereas in Ohio, where it's an open primary and you have Democrats and a large number of Democrats that crossed over yesterday to vote for John Kasich and Donald Trump, you can't say that about Florida. You really see where the Republicans are voting.
Florida was astonishing for him. He won in virtually every, he certainly won every congressional district. He won in every neighborhood. The only neighborhoods Marco Rubio won were his mother's and his. I mean, at one point in his speech, he said his mother was able for the first time to vote for her own son for president of the United States. It's a good thing she did, because he didn't get a whole lot of more votes out of Florida.
Bill, that brings me up to what I think is a significant point that apparently was overlooked by a lot of the commentators last night. But after 50 years, last night demonstrated the death knell of the disproportionately large Cuban influence in South Florida and in Miami. I think now, with a realization of normalization of relations with Cuba and last night's primary, their influence now has gone down.
It was that wasn't the only thing that was killed last night. Reince Priebus's outreach plan for the Republican Party was just shattered.
Let's do this. I do want to have a larger conversation about where the Republican race is headed. We should talk a little bit about Marco Rubio and certainly John Kasich. But let's get a break out of the way and come back to do all of that. It's 2:30 on Wednesday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. Back in just a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, former NPR foreign correspondent Ann Garrels talks about the lives of Russians far from Moscow. Though they face a struggling economy and widespread corruption, most support the country's president. Her new book is called Putin Country, A Journey into the Real Russia. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on your GPB station.
When your son is murdered, your whole outlook changes.
With my kids now, I will make sure they are trained to use a gun. That will be one of the main things that will be done.
But how do you solve murders when the community doesn't trust you?
One of the challenges we face, it's a significant challenge, is the loss of public trust and legitimacy from the police.
Join GPB News next week as we look at crime, cops, and community. GPB News, empowering you one story at a time.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden is here. The editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Kevin Riley, joins us. Republican consultant Loretta Lepore is with us. And, of course, the political writer for the AJC, Jim Galloway, is here. We're at PoliticsGPB on the Twitter. We got a tweet from Buffalo4Trump, who says liberals have no problem putting down a domestic terrorist. I think that he's really against the nomination that the president made today. I'm trying to interpret that. On the other hand,
Good call.
Yeah, Riley Jeff said Republicans only believe in democracy when they win. They've gone from obstruction to coup. So we've got people weighing in on this and a lot more. Let's talk about your former governor and congressman. You've been there for a long time, Kevin, right?
Yeah.
John Kasich.
You know, I have to tell you, Jim Galloway and I started talking about this almost a year ago, whether Kasich could pull this off. And, I think we both think that he is not the person Hillary Clinton would want to face in a general election either. But here's my thing. I haven't recognized this John Kasich, or didn't recognize him at first, because in 2008, when he ran for governor in Ohio against Ted Strickland, then the incumbent, he was more like Donald Trump, I would say, in this way. He came out very aggressively and set Strickland reeling before, and Strickland never recovered. But also, I was at the first debate in that gubernatorial race, and Kasich off camera was like watching Rodney Dangerfield. He was fidgety and nervous and everything, and he looked very uncomfortable. And when that light came on, he was focused and clear and persuasive, and he remained that way. And I think that he's the kind of guy who's very determined. You know, he's trying to figure out a way to win this thing, and that's been interesting to watch. The other thing I keep telling everyone is John Kasich is the moderate, you know, in the way this thing has been cast. But in Ohio, he's really seen, I think, as very conservative.
Yeah, he tried to pass right to work, right. In Ohio, failed at that, or it passed, but then it was repealed.
It was a very, very divisive thing.
Teachers aren't happy with him. I think he supports Common Core at this point.
Yeah, he's also passed or pushed some very aggressive anti-abortion measures too.
Let me ask you: is he? I mean. Kasich voters on Tuesday, where do they go in November if he's not on the ballot? Are they Trump people or are they Hillary people?
I think it remains to be seen. But really, I think that if you kind of watch Ohio, people are not extreme. You know what I mean? And I think that's why, like, the Medicaid thing in Ohio.
Wait, Kevin, any community that can continue to support the Cleveland Browns to the extent they do, they're extreme.
Well, I'm part of that extremist group, unfortunately, yes. but I do think it'll come down to some very pragmatic things, and it remains to be seen. But Donald Trump has found a way to tap into a lot of frustration and a lot of the disenfranchisement that people feel, and there's a lot of that.
So I want to throw this out to everybody, but I'd like to play a little sound from the Kasich speech last night, because he says some things. We're going to listen to the portion where he talks about his record as governor, and then just a few more seconds of the kind of inspiring message he's trying to get out there. I have to say that as I listened to his speech, I thought, I've heard him say this before, but he's been lost completely in this race. He's completely, he's underreported on. For good reason, he's not winning anything. And last night, Jim Galloway, I'm going to ask you after we come back, I thought the message that he gives, if it gets broader play because he won the one state, does that have some opportunities, hold some opportunities for him? This is a slightly longer soundbite, but I'd really appreciate your listening to it.
You know, when I became
governor of Ohio, I went to New York, and I met with some of the rating agencies. Things were bad. We had lost 350,000 jobs. We were $8 billion in the hole, and our credit was hanging in the balance. And they told me, we're about to cut up your credit card and give you a new one where you can't buy as much. We're now up 400,000-plus jobs. We're running a $2 billion surplus. Our pensions are secure. We've cut taxes by more than any governor in this country. And we are leaving no one behind. Not the mentally ill, the drug addicted, the working poor. And I also want you to know that it's been my intention to make you proud. It's been my intention to have young people all across this country watch somebody and enter into politics, even though I labored in obscurity for so long, people counting me out, people in Ohio saying, why don't they ever call on him, okay? We get all that. But we put one foot in front of the other, and I want to remind you again tonight that I will not take the low road to the highest office in the land.
So, Jim, Kasich's path to the nomination is still torturous and probably undoable. But that message about turning around Ohio, assuming, and we can ask Kevin about that, it's correct, it's a pretty powerful message.
To me, the most powerful phrase in that is leaving no one behind. And that gets after the Medicaid expansion. But it also runs counter to the current Republican current, if you will, that says all my problems are due to somebody else, to this group or that group. There is a Ronald Reagan feel to that, if you will.
Yeah. Loretta, it does, I think Kevin said something worth picking up on. With the kind of messaging that a John Kasich has, if I'm the Hillary Clinton camp right now, I'd be grateful that he probably can't get to the nomination because he's got to be her worst nightmare in a general election.
He is totally her worst nightmare. I mean, the polling is bearing that out. In Ohio, when they did the exit polling, they found that Ohioans rated the economy their number one concern. And when they asked them who they voted for, more than 50% who rated the economy their number one concern voted for John Kasich. So he has some solid credentials there. The challenge for John Kasich is how he raises his message from just being an Ohio governor. We talked about this at the beginning of the cycle with Scott Walker. Could he take his governor's message, his governor's popularity, and translate that into a national campaign? And that's where John Kasich is, but he has much less time to make it happen.
Yeah.
I would say, though, to your original point, the reason that John Kasich is a threat to Hillary is that he has the federal experience as well. He has served in Congress. He can go toe-to-toe with her on that experience. He can go toe-to-toe with her on a number of issues that some of the other candidates cannot.
Buddy, at this point, he's really nothing more than a favorite son, having won just his home state.
Yes, he's won his own state, and even Newt Gingrich did that 8 years ago. Now, I'm a good friend of John Kasich. I've known him for many years, and we could do a whole lot worse as President of the United States than John Kasich. However, I don't think things were quite as bad in Ohio as they said they were when he came in. I don't think they're quite as good now as he says they are. But still, he's made a lot of progress and done a lot of great things. At the same time, the crossover numbers were just outstanding from the Democratic side to the Republican side. People came out and either wanted to vote for John Kasich or against Donald Trump. That was a big factor, too, in yesterday's election.
Kevin, are things that much better in Ohio under his leadership?
Well, as any politician, and I guess we could check what we've run on our Truthometer in the paper, any politician tends to take more credit than they deserve and cast about more blame than others deserve. So I think without question, John Kasich accomplished some big things as governor. I think without question, he benefited from an economy that turned around nationally. And so I think, yeah, is Ohio better off? How much did John Kasich have to do with it? It can't possibly be as much as he portrays it.
Okay. One of the other big moments last night, the departure of Marco Rubio from the race. He just got, as we said earlier, trounced by Donald Trump in his home state. And it was an awful defeat. There had been some talk that maybe his campaign was considering staying in the race simply to hold on to their delegates. By the way, I haven't checked this yet. Does a suspended campaign hold on to its delegates?
Yes, it does.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
It holds on to its delegates, and it can continue to raise money if there's a deficit.
All right, so there was no question in listening to Marco Rubio last night, who's always gotten credit for being a strong speaker, that he was already calculating his remarks to 4 years down the line. He had accepted his fate finally, and now we're seeing the first campaign speech of his 2020 race for the White House.
Well, America's in the middle of a real political storm, a real tsunami, and we should have seen this coming. Look, people are angry and people are very frustrated. And quite frankly, there's millions of people in this country that are tired of being looked down upon, tired of being told by these self-proclaimed elitists that they don't know what they're talking about and they need to instead listen to the so-called smart people. But we also need a new political establishment in our party. Not one that looks down on people that live outside of the District of Columbia. Not one that tells young people that they need to wait their turn and wait in line. And not one that's more interested in winning elections than it is in solving problems. And so, while it is not God's plan that I be president in 2016 or maybe ever, and while today my campaign is suspended, the fact that I've even come this far is evidence of how special America truly is. I ask the American people, do not give in to the fear. Do not give in to the frustration. We can disagree about public policy. We can disagree about it vibrantly, passionately. But we are a hopeful people, and we have every right to be hopeful.
So, Jim, he says that the establishment has to stop looking down on people and telling them they're too young. They have to wait their turn. I can only think of one person that would apply
in this contest. Yeah, Carly Fiorina, I think.
You made a remark as we went into that soundbite that when I talk about 2020, you think he's got a closer goal in mind.
Yeah, the 2018 race for governor. I mean, that's that to me would be more within reach, possibly, if he hasn't really sullied his reputation in Florida.
That's always been his game plan. You know, if you talk to anybody in Florida, is that, you know, this is his backup plan. He's going to run for governor. But Marco Rubio's problems were bigger than Donald Trump in Florida. So his constituents were very unhappy with him and the job that he has done as a U.S. senator. And so this just shined a real spotlight on that. And then on top of that, you have Pam Biondi, who is the attorney general in Florida, who has every intention of running for governor and who endorsed Donald Trump. So the dynamics of who's governor in Florida the next go around is going to be really challenging.
Which of the two of them do you think will be better to solve that water problem Georgia has with Florida?
I think we should ask Sam Olens. Sam Olens has both of those personally.
That's right.
He does.
So, okay. Let's conclude this conversation about the Republicans with a question. Buddy, let me start with you as the Democrat in the room. Where does this leave the Republican race for president? Trump is on path now by winning Florida but losing Ohio. He can't say it's virtually wrapped up. It's still questionable, but it's more and more likely that he is going to go to the convention with all but a handful maybe of delegates that he's short to win, right?
In my view, it's either Trump or Cruz. And also in my view, I think Trump is more electable than Cruz is when you get right down to it. That's up to the Republicans, of course. They have to make that choice. But it's what we call a Hobson's choice. And there's no good choice to make. But I don't think that Kasich, as much as I like Kasich and would like to see him compete for the presidency, I don't think that he will be in the hunt in the end.
So, Kevin, it's the first mention of Ted Cruz. I didn't mention him, and you know what? Last night during all the coverage, Ted Cruz, he didn't have a terrible, terrible night. But there were very low expectations for him for the most part in the big states. So he got lost in the shuffle last night. Is he still a real contender?
I think he is, and as long as this thing goes on, he's going to be there. And I think, you know, we've had so many surprises, I don't think anyone really wants to think that there couldn't be more. But I just think that it's very hard to look at this and not see Trump getting the nomination. And I get that there are all these procedures and maneuvers that can happen at the convention. But in the end, you'd be looking at tens of millions of people who voted for the guy, and then telling them that despite their choice, it doesn't matter. And you know, Trump made that comment today about riots breaking out, and that's been a big news item if he doesn't get the nomination. But the point is that at some level, it is a demonstration of the will of the voters.
Yeah, I think it's more likely that another scenario might arise. I mean, we've already got some hints that Eric Erickson, over at our friend over at WSB Radio, is part of an effort to maybe seek out and put up a third party candidate.
Yeah, and we know that third party. I mean, within the Republican Party, Paul Ryan kind of dodged a question about whether he might make himself available for the nomination. He kind of said, "Well, we'll see." He didn't unequivocally say no, which was interesting, I thought as well.
Bill, here's what scares me as a Democrat, and about the Trump phenomenon is that these people are coming to vote who've never voted before, who've never participated in the process before, and all of a sudden they're coming in huge numbers, and the numbers of participation in Republican primaries are way, way up in traditional Democratic states, and that should be of some worry to us as Democrats.
So, Loretta, go ahead. You comment on that, and then I'll ask you the question.
Well, I was going to say, to Buddy's point, I think Republicans are worried for the same reason, because whoever is at the top of the ticket is going to impact all of those down-ticket races, and Republicans in the Senate have 24 very contentious races ahead of them, 10 which are in blue or purple states. And so, you know, for them, it's also a matter of not just, you know, who's at the top of the ticket, but for a number of reasons, not just the personality itself, but for what happens to all of those other candidates down ticket.
So, Kevin, you alluded to it. Let me read you the exact quote from Donald Trump, who did say if he should be within a very small number of delegates from the nomination when they get to Cleveland, he's predicting there could be trouble. If you disenfranchise those people, his people, and you say, well, I'm sorry, but you're 100 votes short, I think you would have problems like you've never seen before. You can hear him saying this, can't you? I think bad things would happen. I really do. I believe that. I wouldn't lead it, but I think bad things would happen. This continues the rhetoric in which he seems more than happy to inflame his supporters and even obliquely in this case suggest that perhaps they ought to figure out a way to have active protests at the convention.
Well, one of my concerns as someone who was born and grew up in Cleveland is that, you know, if we end up Cleveland landing that convention was such a coup for that community, and now there are people that are worried about
it. As a Chicagoan who was around in 1968, yeah. I feel your pain.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a tough thing because, you know, he is tapping into that anger, and that has been part of the rhetoric, certainly, on the right for a while now. And so there's absolutely something there that I think many of us, including those of us in the media, are trying to figure out.
All right. We'll be back on Friday at 3:00 to be able to talk more about the presidential race. But we have an awful lot cooking down at the Capitol right now, Jim Galloway, with we're 3 days, including today, away from sine die. Why don't we talk about some of the top issues down there after we take our final break of the show? This is Political Rewind at 2:48.
For filmmaker Trey Edward Schultz, the new movie Krisha is really personal. He based the movie off his family's experience with addiction and cast his relatives in the main roles.
Certain scenes became so real, we'd just take a break and make sure everyone's okay.
Plus, unpacking Tuesday's primaries later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
It's time for spring cleaning. Donate your used car to GPB. Just call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate online at gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
We have a tweet from J.G. Perez. Why do you almost never have Sanders supporters on your panel? Guilty. We have, because I'm not sure, we've had people on the show who are supporters of Bernie Sanders, but an awful lot of us on this show aren't supporting anyone.
No, no, and we keep asking Killer Mike.
That's right. Killer Mike, come on. We've invited Killer Mike on this show about 5 times.
We ought to see if Killer Mike would join our Capitol Reporting Bureau
there
staff
go.
There, Jim.
At whose expense?
Didn't you have Senator Fort on your
We've
show?
We've had Fort
he's
on
a,
the show. We
he's
had
a Bernie his... guy, but he hadn't come out for Bernie before he came.
Well, in any case, thank you for the tweet. So let's talk about the Capitol. I thought this was sort of a bombshell the other day, Jim Galloway. The campus carry was sailing through. It sailed through the House. It came to the Senate last Friday. They had a long and difficult debate on a Friday afternoon especially. It passed there. The governor had indicated, I'll sign it. And then suddenly, at the beginning of this week, what do we get?
What a difference a weekend makes. You think he talked to somebody, maybe. Yeah, he came out and he says, now I've got some serious problems with this campus carry bill. You've got a situation where daycare centers on university campuses might be exposed to weapons. You've got high school students. Suddenly, we're concerned with high school students coming onto college campuses and how that mix will affect it. Interesting, both points were raised during the Democrats during the Senate debate.
Yep. Rick Jaspers, by the way, who is the author of that bill, will be on with me and lawmakers tonight. So people who are interested in this might watch. Buddy, our booking producer, Darrell Welch, has a theory. He says, well, this is Nathan Deal's former Democratic roots showing.
No, I think what happens, I think an adult finally entered the room for a change and started listening to the school administrators and the chancellor whom he caused to be appointed and the members of the Board of Regents that he appointed.
We should make that point because another one of his objections was that he thought that the university officialdom ought to be allowed to decide how campus carry is implemented on campus.
Right, and in most states where they have campus carry, that provision is in that legislation.
Jim, do you think it? I can't help but think that the governor is part of this is him asserting himself. You know, a lot of us have been waiting for him on certain things to assert himself since he says he doesn't have another election to worry about, and I think he cares a lot about his legacy, and you know this whole thing with Georgia being the best place to do business and being very careful not to do things that. Around which the nuance is unimportant, but the big message about the state could be a problem.
Right, and I think he's still trying to figure out how to do that correctly. I mean, he tossed out a hint early in the season, in this session, that he was no longer that campus carry was no longer radioactive. But then he didn't lay out any provisions of what he would of any limits on that. And he still hasn't, so far as I know.
Well, and he walks this balance between I don't want to get involved in how legislators make policy. I don't want to be involved in the nitty gritty. But yet I feel like I have to step up and say something when I think I need to. Now, the governor could have, in his purview, waited until he got to bill signing after the session was over and he was in a room with his policy advisors. And they said, hey, governor, this doesn't look so good. Or somebody else weighed in and said, this doesn't look so good. And the legislature would have had no opportunity at that point to fix anything. So he is giving them latitude to come back and make some changes while it's still viable.
So buddy, I just wonder about the political maneuvering on something like this. I had made the point, and I might be wrong about this, that this year the Board of Regents maintained a much lower profile publicly in terms of being opposed to it. They made it clear they were opposed, but they seemed to keep their profile kind of low on this. And I sort of wonder, is it possible that this was all playing out behind the scenes and that the regents and the governor came to a realization that they couldn't stop the bill on the floor, but maybe if the governor came back and said, make some changes, guys, does that make sense?
I think it's entirely possible. And again, to reiterate my point, is that the chancellor, Hank Huckabee, was the governor's recommendation. Most of the Board of Regents now have been appointed or at least reappointed by the governor, so he owns the entire program now, and so he's got responsibility. He just can't walk away and say, let somebody else handle it.
There's also a little bit of collateral damage here. You've got a governor's race that's coming open here in 2018, and you have a lieutenant governor, Casey Cagle, who is very, very much a candidate, I think, who has now, whose chamber now has passed campus carry. And that says something in a general election.
So, you know, Kevin, I talked to a couple of legislators who've come through here for lawmakers, and Republicans saying, gee, we have a Republican governor, we have Republican Senate, Republican House, and here we are again in 2016. We may not get any religious liberty bill. We may have problems now getting campus carry through. Who would have ever thought that was going to happen?
Well, yeah, and when we went into the session, we said that it's an election year, right? And they raised taxes last year and didn't get any of this stuff passed either. And so they were looking, you know, for some of that red meat. And now that seems to be not working out so well. I mean, the religious liberty thing remains to be seen. But
yes.
And I'll be interested to see what the governor does there, because I think his concerns about the message to the rest of the world from Georgia about that, his concerns will be even greater there. And again, people are not going to get excited about some nuance about that bill. Georgia either passes religious freedom liberty or religious liberty bill or not.
So,
and that's what that will be the story.
All right, we're very low on time, got about a minute. Jim Galloway, the House, you say, this afternoon, debating the new version of a MARTA bill.
This may be the most important thing that comes out of the legislature this year. You've got a revised MARTA rail extension bill that would apply only to the city of Atlanta, would let the city on referendum levy a half penny tax. It would separate transportation policy in North Fulton from the city of Atlanta, take it out of the MARTA rail realm. You'd give North Fulton and South Fulton control over road and bridge spending in their areas.
Okay. Loretta, you've been working on this for transparency's sake here. Is this compromise likely to appeal to everybody down there?
I think so. I think the transit advocates in particular are fine with it. They would have, of course, liked to have seen their original bill, Senate Bill 330, pass that was much more aggressive and broad-reaching. But I think that they're willing to go with whatever progress can be made. They think it's critical that we begin to make progress, and the city of Atlanta is vital.
Money go for in the city of Atlanta if you don't have MARTA extensions up to North Fulton County?
It
could be for any rail, light rail, heavy rail project. So it could be the Beltline. It could be the rail line out to Clifton Corridor, although to complete that, which would go out to Emory, the DeKalb delegation of the legislature would have to come back next year and pass local legislation to complete that. I should say that the Clifton Corridor is a very desirable project for government funding. The federal government would like to see that rail line put in.
Buddy, I'm going to give you the last
word. And not a word about those two Supreme Court justices being added and slip right through, which will give the governor the opportunity to appoint five of the current nine Supreme Court justices.
You know, on this show, we have often tried to get panelists put into positions of power. If the governor would be willing to reach across the aisle, I think Buddy Darden would be a heck of a Georgia State Supreme Court justice.
I'm too old.
You couldn't come on the show anymore, probably, either.
That would not be a good thing. Buddy Darden, Kevin Riley, Loretta Lepore, Jim Galloway, thank you so much for a really terrific post-super Tuesday last night. It was great having you all here. Remember, if you can't be near the radio when we're on the air, you can always go to our website at gpb.org and listen to the show there. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. You'll also find Two Way Street on Second Thought with Celeste Headlee and a lot of your favorite NPR shows there. In the meantime, we will be back here again Friday at 3 o'clock with every bit as much to talk about then as we did today. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again on Friday.